The question I have been asked to address is there a human nature? Surprise, surprise, I'm going to say yes. Sorry to spoil the plot. But saying yes isn't enough. As I will try to make clear, we could say yes to the idea of human nature, but still have an inadequate account of it. We need to have an adequate account, an adequate conception. And by that, I mean, I'll explain more below, pretty much the conception that normal people have, the conception of ourselves as rational animals with free will and so forth. Having an adequate conception of human nature turns out to require some serious metaphysical commitments. Commitments that have, at least to some people, seemed questionable in light of questions raised by modern science since the 17th century. To discuss all this in one short lecture, I'll have to cover a lot of ground. That will mean skimping on the technical details and sketching things out in broad strokes. Putting it differently, what I will be saying will be rather short on the giving of arguments and rather long on the making of connections. I hope that's okay. Anyway, it's what I'm going to do. Forewarned is forearmed. I will first briefly discuss a way of saying no to the idea of human nature. Second, I will discuss a way of thinking about human nature. It seems to me rather unstable or unclear. It might give us a notion of human nature, albeit an inadequate one, but then again, it might not really give us a notion of human nature at all. Third, I will explain more explicitly what I mean by an adequate notion of human nature. Fourth, I will discuss some requirements for holding to an adequate notion of human nature, along with showing that these requirements require us to move beyond a so-called, quote-unquote, naturalistic worldview. Fifth, I will discuss and cast doubt on reasons for insisting on the truth of a so-called, quote-unquote, naturalistic worldview. Lastly, I will propose reasons for insisting on retaining our adequate conception of human nature. That's the outline. First, then, here's a reason for denying that there is a human nature. You deny that there's a human nature because you deny that anything has any nature at all. On this way of thinking, there's nothing special about human beings that makes it true that there's no human nature. There's no horse nature either, no electron nature, nothing. Each thing is utterly unique. As Dr. Seuss says, not one of them is like another. A view like this one is pretty extreme, obviously. I'm not going to explore it in this talk because I think it's not really on the table in our conference. Our conference is about faith, science, and nature. You can't really talk about nature if you don't think that there are natures. The same holds true of science. If it makes no sense to talk about, for example, what electrons are like in general, then you can't really do science. Science is about finding general truths. And there can't be general truths if each thing is unique and if nothing shares a nature with anything else. So let's assume for present purposes that at least some things have natures. Assuming there are elementary particles, they will have natures, even if nothing else does. Now that last little remark leads to our next topic, the approach that I'm calling unstable or unclear. The approach bases itself on physical science. So, with apologies to the scientists in the room, let me begin by just saying the tiniest little bit about the scientific starting point that the view takes. And I hope I can do this in a way that's not too embarrassingly far off from reality. So, it's just this simple. Let's just suppose that there are a few kinds of elementary particles. 3, 17, it doesn't really matter. And suppose, second, that everything in the physical world is made up out of them. Now, if that were true, then by hypothesis, each human being would be made out of elementary particles. At least in theory, we could describe each human as involving such and such elementary particles, interacting in such and such ways. And if we took the descriptions of all the humans and we found out what was common to them all, that would be a description of human nature. On this way of thinking, to be a human being, to have a human nature, would just be to be a composite of such and such particles interacting in such and such ways. If someone said this, would he be affirming that there's a human nature? Well, think of a pile of sand. Most of us would agree, I think, that a pile of sand is a bunch of grains of sand interacting in various ways. For example, interacting by way of gravity and stickiness. If you could somehow know all the facts about all the grains, how big they are, how they're shaped, where they're located, how they're moving, how they're acted on by external agents, and so on, if you knew all that, then you would know the shape of the sand pile, you would know how long it was going to endure, and so forth. In one sense, to know this would be to know some truths about the sand pile. However, in another sense, it might seem that all you would really know is truths about the grains of sand. It might seem, in other words, that there were no truths about the sand pile itself beyond the individual truths about the grains. The sand pile, you might say, is nothing but a bunch of grains of sand. The sand pile would be, as they say, reducible to the grains. If you think like this, then you are, in some sense, a reductionist about the sand pile. Now, let's not let the word reductionist scare us. Maybe reductionism about sand piles is okay. I, in fact, am strongly inclined to think that it is okay, and that there's nothing more to sand piles than sand grains and the internal and external interactions that the sand grains enter into. In a sense, this means that there's no such thing as the nature of a sand pile. There are the natures of the grains, the nature of gravity, and so forth, but that's all. If there is no nature to the sand pile, beyond the nature of the sand, and so on, then why even talk about the sand pile? Obviously, it would be an enormous hassle to always have to list all the millions of grains of sand involved. So as a matter of linguistic convenience, naturally, we will continue to use the expression, the sand pile. But that's not the issue I'm getting at. Convenience aside, is the sand pile really a thing? Consider, for example, my red pen, the Eiffel Tower, and the oldest left shoe of the youngest congressional staffer. Do those three items make up a thing? Pretty clearly not. There are philosophers who would disagree, but pretty clearly not. So if they don't make up a thing, why should a few million grains of sand make up a thing? Now, if you find yourself pulled along by thoughts like these, you are moving from reductionism about the sand pile to eliminativism about the sand pile. You are leaning towards saying that, convenience aside, really, there just is no sand pile at all. And we should eliminate it from our theory of the universe. With all this about the sand pile in mind, we can revisit the proposal that human nature is the same thing as a bunch of elementary particles, interacting in certain ways with each other and the environment. Is this proposal okay? It might not be if that means that a human being is only interacting particles in a reductionistic way. Even if reductionism is okay for sand piles, it might not be okay for human beings. Further, as noted, once you've started down the road of reductionism, it's hard not to turn onto the avenue of eliminativism. There's a huge literature on this topic. I can't do justice to it here, or anywhere really, but I think it's safe to say that if you hold that humans are only particles in interaction, it's hard to avoid reductionism. And if you hold reductionism, it's hard to avoid eliminativism. Now then, to bring this section to a close, let me clarify what I meant before when I said that this theory of human nature is unstable or unclear. If it just collapses into reductionism, and perhaps even into eliminativism, then it's not really a theory of human nature at all. Words like human nature and human being will just be shorthand ways of talking about elementary particles. But suppose it doesn't collapse into reductionism and eliminativism. What then? What kind of theory would it give us? Well, obviously it would give us a quote-unquote naturalistic picture of human nature. That would be the whole point. But is such a picture good enough? Okay, that leads me to the next topic. What it means for a notion of human nature to be adequate or good enough. Actually, I think there's a kind of ambiguity in the very idea of a conception as being adequate. It's easier to explain this by talking about inadequacy, however. So that's what I'll do. One thing it could mean to call a theory inadequate would simply be that it's wrong or inaccurate. For example, please grant me the assumption that God is not a turnip. Is that okay? Okay. So on that assumption, a conception of God that says that God is a turnip is inadequate in the sense that it's a wrong conception of God. But something more would seem to be going on in such a case. Someone who is thinking of God as being a turnip isn't merely making a mistake. Someone who thinks of God as a turnip seems to be confused on a deeper level. This concept is inadequate in a deeper way. The turnip theory of God isn't just a bad theory of God, in the way you might call Patripassianism a bad theory of God. Turnips are so far from being divine that the turnip theory doesn't really count as a theory of God at all. If someone told you God was a turnip, you wouldn't respond by saying, no, God is not really a turnip, but instead something more like a being that possesses aseity. Instead, you would ask a few questions intended to find out whether the person you were talking to actually knew the meaning of the word God and or the meaning of the word turnip. If what we call God is actually a turnip, then it's not God at all. Better to admit to just being an atheist than to lay claim to being an advocate of turnip theology. Now, perhaps there's not a sharp line between these two kinds of inadequacy. Still, I think it's helpful to have made this distinction because it helps me to bring out something that's important for this talk. We are interested in human nature. If someone says that he's got a theory of human nature and that a human being is a bunch of particles interacting in a shape that is approximately the same as that of a mannequin, then while on the one hand, I do want to say that that's wrong, on the other hand, I want to say in some sense that if that's what you mean by human nature, then really there's no such thing as human nature, and there's no such thing as human beings. To count as a theory of human nature, what you say has to somehow do justice to the thought that a human being is a rational animal with free will, moral agency, some kind of intrinsic worth, and so on. So this, very roughly, is the idea of a human nature. This is very roughly the idea of human nature that's worth having, if we can get it. From now on, I will just set aside as irrelevant any notion of human nature that falls well short of this. To exaggerate a bit, it's all or nothing. Either we get the robust notion of human nature, or forget it. Aut Caesar, aut nihil. Hot or cold, but not lukewarm. With this in mind, let us ask whether a naturalistic conception of human nature can be adequate. Of course, it depends on what you mean by a naturalistic conception. Here, I think it is good to remind oneself of what Barry Stroud said a few decades ago in a lecture called The Charm of Naturalism. If we define naturalism in a focused and narrow way, thereby giving it a lot of bite and philosophical interest, then it's very hard to defend. If, on the other hand, we start loosening up the notion of naturalism and broadening it to include more things in order to make it easier to defend and more plausible, it becomes less and less clear what makes it naturalistic. So his idea is, at a certain point, there's no point in calling it naturalism anymore. And it's like a magic, his idea is, it's like a little magic charm. You can just tell people, see, I'm a naturalist, and they think, oh, that's respectable. But you've expanded the notion so much. So the notion is actually kind of slippery and suspicious in that way. In any event, I will now discuss three things that we need if we want to be able to talk about humans in the adequate way I just described, as having reason, free will, and so forth. First, on any adequate account of human nature, a human being cannot simply be a bunch of smaller things, particles, cells, whatever, a bunch of smaller things that are hanging out together, however closely interrelated. A human being has got to be one thing, one entity, one single being. Why? Well, if a human being is not one thing, then it will not be strictly true to say that a human being, you or I, for example, does this or that. For example, if you are not one thing, then it will not be strictly true, but true only in a manner of speaking, that you kicked a soccer ball or baked a cake or whatever. Now, the point just made applies to subhuman beings just as well as it does to humans. If a dog isn't one thing, then it won't be strictly true, but true only in a manner of speaking, that it bites the mailman. But the unity requirement seems even more pressing when we think of free and responsible actions or thoughts. What could it even mean to say that what made a certain free choice or solved a certain equation was not one thing, but a multitude of things? So the first aspect of a good theory of human nature will be that it gives a solid account of the human being as one thing, one substance, one entity. Can a naturalistic account do this? Again, it depends on what you mean by a naturalistic account. If the naturalistic account allows only for particles and interactions among them, then it is not clear whether it can give us an account of a human being's unity. Perhaps it can, but it's pretty doubtful. On the other hand, if we allow for some robustly Aristotelian notion of form not just as the arrangement of particles, not just the arrangement, but form is the principle that's responsible for the arrangement of the particles, then we would seem to find ourselves in a stronger place as far as unity goes. But of course, if we do that, then our naturalistic credentials will be diminished. The next point has to do with normativity. If the cells in your arterial walls are arranged in one way, then your blood will stay inside your arteries. If, on the other hand, the cells in your arterial walls are arranged in a somewhat different way, then your blood will come gushing out. Now, most of us would be inclined to say that when your blood stays inside your arteries, then, all other things being equal, that's good. Whereas, when your blood comes gushing out of your arteries, then, again, all other things being equal, that's bad. But how can this difference, good versus bad, be represented in a purely naturalistic way of thinking? Think of those two different ways of arranging the particles in the walls of your arteries. Does one of them obey the laws of physics or geometry better than the other? Here we should remember what Descartes says, namely that a clock that keeps bad time obeys the laws of nature just as well as a clock that keeps good time does. The difference between good and bad here, Descartes says, is only a matter of our perspective, not a matter of how the clock is in itself. This way of thinking about nature as being a no-go zone for objective norms and values is quite common in naturalistic ways of thinking. But I don't think it's good enough if we want to have an adequate account of human nature. Notions such as sickness and health, ability and disability, normality and abnormality, success and failure, Without these, we cannot make sense out of human life in anything like a satisfactory way. Again, the point applies outside the human realm as well. Dogs, too, can be sick or healthy. But norms are more important in understanding humans, especially if we want to build our moral notions around human nature. Understanding the difference between acting well and acting badly as rooted in a difference between flourishing and not flourishing in accordance with human nature. Interestingly, this approach to ethics, which has been brought back into style by authors like Philip LaFoot, is now often called naturalism, not because it's naturalistic in the sense that I've been discussing, but because it's based on nature, on human nature. So the point can be put somewhat paradoxically. Ethical naturalism would appear to require metaphysical non-naturalism in its support. But I mean, that's just like a bad joke, right? Because the word naturalism is being used in two different ways. So for example, you might not be able to have a good understanding of ethics based on human nature unless you had some notion of final coverage. Of teleology. Okay, let me now turn to a third point, one that applies only to humans, as far as we know. That point is reason. It should be clear to everyone that a conception of human nature that doesn't involve reason is a complete non-starter. Of course, this isn't clear to everyone, because everyone includes professional philosophers, not all of whom can see this point. Anyway, can a naturalistic viewpoint keep a place for reason in its understanding of human nature? There are reasons to doubt it. Some reasons have to do with the unity point made earlier. How can there be thoughts without a single unified thinker? Others have to do with various aspects of thought itself. Its determinateness, for example, or its universality. It's hard to see how a purely naturalistic account can handle these. Whereas, again, the appeal to form and soul seem to be at least a step in the right direction. I have argued, or rather suggested, that for at least three reasons, any naturalism worthy of the name, a materialistic, reductionistic naturalism, is inadequate to the task of giving us an account of human nature that is worthy of that name. But that by itself doesn't actually prove that we should move beyond reductions by talking about forms or souls or final causes or whatever. Maybe instead we should just accept the sad fact that we can't have an adequate account of human nature. Maybe we should just accept that being human is basically nothing more than being a certain type of system of particles, without much unity, without any normativity, and without reason. Why accept this sad proposal? One reason is something that I suspect has more influence over us than we realize, even though it has essentially no evidential value at all. I suspect that many of us accept this sad proposal because, well, that's the way educated people think nowadays. Lovejoy says in The Great Chain of Being that every age has certain views that just seem right to it. Like some ages are kind of optimistic and others are pessimistic. I think that in our time, reductionism and sort of hardcore physicalism, they just seem like the kinds of views that you're supposed to hold. All your friends do. Let's abandon and turn to a much more reasonable reason for sticking to naturalism. What I'm thinking of is the idea that we need naturalism for science. In other words, on this approach, if naturalism isn't true, then science can't be true either. And therefore, we just have to bite the bullet of naturalism, even at the cost of our self-understanding as humans, because we know that science is true. In response, let me say that we should not be so quick to assume that we can't have science without naturalism. A lot of philosophers seem to think that we can't, but maybe they're wrong. One main sticking point is known as the causal closure of the physical. Basically, this is the idea that every physical event must have a sufficient physical cause or a set of physical causes that are sufficient together. Otherwise, according to this reasoning, the conservation laws have been thrown out, and science doesn't work. If you object that while every physical event has a physical cause, it could also have a non-physical cause, a lot of philosophers will say, no, you can't have a sufficient cause and then also other causes too. They wouldn't be doing anything. If this is right, then, to bring the argument to its conclusion, we can't rightly talk about the soul moving the body, for example, but need to restrict what we say to naturalistic explanations. And if what I've been suggesting in this talk is right, namely that an adequate account of human nature has to take us beyond naturalism, then that adequate account is ruled out by the needs of science. So that's the thought. But is this argument really decisive? One worry about it has to do with the status of the causal closure principle. Is it really a known truth? Or is it more like a guiding methodological principle to scientists? Thou shalt seek only physical causes. It might be a perfectly good methodological principle without being literally true. And it's worth asking how we would actually know that the causal closure principle were true. I don't think it can be proved by anything that we would call the scientific method. You could argue for it philosophically, but then again, you could argue against it philosophically. For example, by pointing out that it conflicts with our human self-understanding, there's a lot of difficult work to be done here. And a lot of it would be done in the very technical field of philosophy of science. I'm not trying to make any definitive remarks, but I am saying that the causal closure principle should not just be swallowed uncritically, as if it were the most obvious thing in the world. Now for my last topic. I just said that one mark against the causal closure principle is that it conflicts with our human self-understanding. But why think that our human self-understanding is true? It would be a big deal to give it up, obviously. But sometimes the truth hurts. Well, there are reasons for holding on to it that go well beyond sentimental attachment. Let me sketch out two of them. They are related conceptually, but not historically. But I will present them separately. The first is derived from Edmund Husserl, a German philosopher who died in 1938, and who is usually thought of as the founder of the phenomenological movement. In his book, The Crisis of European Sciences and Transcendental Phenomenology, Husserl argues, among many, many other things, that scientific understanding, which, by the way, he strongly supports, scientific understanding presupposes the sort of everyday understanding that we have as ordinary people living in what he calls the life world. In order to work as a scientist, I cannot treat my measuring devices and my lab assistants as if they were systems of particles. I have to treat them as measuring devices and humans. To make a long story short, we cannot jettison our human self-understanding in favor of the picture we get from physics, because the picture we get from physics depends on our ordinary understanding. This argument needs a more rigorous presentation, obviously, but that's enough to show the main idea. A second argument can perhaps be derived from ideas found in Peter Strawson, an English philosopher who died in 2006, and he was a central figure in mid-20th century analytic philosophy, and Donald Davidson, an American analytic philosopher who died in 2003. Whatever its roots, the argument I have in mind looks something like this. If there are certain concepts that we cannot avoid deploying, if there are certain ways in which we must think about the world, in the sense that we can't think about the world in any other way, then if someone says he has an alternative way of thinking about the world to propose, he won't be saying something true. He won't have a truly alternative way of thinking because, by hypothesis, he literally can't avoid thinking in a certain way. Now, if that's the case, what should we say about it? One thing we might say is that, sadly, we humans are trapped in a certain mode of thought. But another thing we might say is that since no one has ever proposed an alternative way of thinking, and no one can, therefore, there is no content to the claim that there is an alternative. Someone might assert that there is an alternative, but if we ask him to tell us about it, he can't. Instead, he just says things that willy-nilly embody a non-alternative. Well, if there is no content to the claim that there is an alternative, maybe the inference to draw is that our unavoidable thoughts just do track reality. How is this related to the question of human nature? If thinking about ourselves in a certain way is truly unavoidable, I haven't shown that it is. But if that turned out to be the case, and if this Strawsonian, Davidsonian kind of argument has force, then perhaps our normal human self-understanding is correct. And if that's true, then we should stick to it, even if it means jettisoning science. Not again, but I think jettisoning science would be required to repeat. The idea that science is incompatible with our ordinary self-understanding has not been proved, at least as far as I can tell. Let me wrap this up. In a rather hand-waving way, I have proposed that we ought to hold out for a robust, adequate notion of human nature, and that we cannot do this without taking on board some fairly serious metaphysical commitments. I have also proposed that while we should be willing to take on these commitments, even at the price of abandoning science, it doesn't really seem that we need to pay that price. That's the good news. But it's also bad news, inasmuch as we need not only to work out an adequate metaphysics and show how it grounds our account of human nature, but we also need to figure out how it relates to science. That's a lot of work. But sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. So let me just say thank you.